All right, this is Dan Philby with the Heroes of HR podcast, and I'm very excited to welcome Wendy Greenland, the CEO of OpenForce. OpenForce has a number of solutions to help companies with intelligent independent contractor management. And Wendy, welcome.
Thank you for having me. It's very exciting. This is your first session, so I'm thrilled to help you inaugurate this podcast.
It is. You just took me from calm to very nervous, mentioning it was our first session. So we're really thrilled to have you in here as a first guest for us. And in full disclosure, our companies are great partners together and we do a lot of work. So we know each other well. And again, couldn't think of a better first guest to have. So welcome.
Thrilled to be here.
I thought we'd start off with some quick hit questions, a bit of a warm-up round just to get to know you a little bit better, Wendy. So you ready for some quick bullet questions?
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. Current company and role, OpenForce and CEO. I'll answer that one. We already mentioned it. But maybe talk a little bit about your education background. You, at your time at ASU, earning a bachelor's degree, what was the best learning takeaway for you?
Oh, at ASU, my bachelor's degree was in psychology. And, when I think back on those days, I was trying to get out of college quickly. And my mom was a psychologist, and I thought, well, this will be an easy way to get in and out of here. And I learned a whole lot, but it was easy for me because growing up with a psychologist for a mother, I took all the tests when she was practicing on me, so it was kind of an easy undergrad. And what I found is that later on, as I really took hold of business and accounting and finance and really began to understand the inner workings of business, I learned that business is built on people. And people and their behaviors are really what you're trying to work towards a common goal. And my psychology undergrad really helped me, I think, grow it as a leader, especially in organizational behavior.
Nice. Good takeaway. And then you went on to your MBA at Grand Canyon University. What was your best learning or takeaway from that experience?
So I owned a business in between my undergrad and my master's degree for 12 years. And during that time, I had a very close friend of mine who was also a mentor. She was an accountant on the first job that I had. She was the accountant and she taught me a lot about accounting and finance. In those early years. And so I thought, hey, I'm going to open this business. It's going to be great. And oh, I had to learn quickly what it meant to really make payroll and get your books together and make sure that they're clean and audited. And there were so many things that I learned. Well, when I went to GCU and I got my MBA, there were gaps that it filled in. So she did a lot of work helping me to grow in that area. But the Master's of Business Administration really helped me fill in the rest of the gaps that I needed in order to really take on private equity, which is where I am today.
And going back maybe early on, I'm not sure how early on, but when you go back and think of whatever was your very first job, what was something you took away from that experience?
So Carolyn, as I mentioned earlier, she was the accountant for Sandia Management Company, and it was a consulting firm. They had several different businesses. They moved me into a training role early on there. And I think what I learned there was a couple of things. First of all, it's not just how smart you are, or how strong you are, or how well you do your job. You are managing politics within any organization. Mm-hmm. And she kind of helped me and mentored me in the politics of that particular mom and pop consulting firm. She helped me kind of navigate through all of the different networking and politics pieces of that role. And I was able to be promoted up to their senior training and then eventually their regional director. And that was a pretty big role for me, so early in my career. And I couldn't have done it without a really strong mentor. So I think probably what I learned early on is you need to put the right people around you to help you fill in the gaps. She filled in the gaps for me in accounting and finance, and then also networking and the politics of growing within an organization.
And if you move on to the time when you became a COO, you did a transition clearly from the CEO role to CEO role, and that that operational to fully strategic management of an entire organization and all the constituents that you have to manage can be a really difficult transition and also one of great learning. What are the great learnings for you during that transition that you successfully made?
Well, that's a really good question. In the transition, I think what surprised me the most is that you have to, when you're chief operating officer, everything is operations and employee focused and running the operations of the business. And suddenly you become CEO and everything is board focused and private. So I work with a private equity team and I work with a board and, I was already attending the board meetings and doing all of those things, but suddenly my bosses and my peers were the board and the private equity team. And so my focus shifted to where I was looking at things from a board perspective and instead of an operations perspective. My first board meeting, I had a board member call me and say, your board slides still look very operational. and kind of mentored me into, okay, in order to, to really... To work with a board, you need to really just give them the so what. It's all about the numbers. I was still thinking too much like an operations team. I was still thinking and communicating in a way that was meaningful to employees. Now all of a sudden, I had to communicate in a way that was meaningful to a board. So the first couple of attempts at my board deck, were. Had to be reworked. Let's put it that way. And I'm like, oh, got it. Okay. I have to think a little differently. So that was an interesting transition. Again, I think that having a network of people, especially women who've done this before, there aren't many who have made that transition. And so having a couple of people that I could call and talk to and work through, how I was thinking about working with the board on those things really did help me through that transitional time. I don't know if you had the same experience, but that was something that I struggled with at first.
Yeah, what you say is resonating a lot with me. I also made a transition from COO to CEO. And I think back to some of the people that I spoke to about that transition along the way and how they helped out. And that emphasis on the peer group is really meaningful. So having a great peer group around you that can help out makes a big, big difference.
Sure does.
We're going to spend a little more time talking more specifically about the independent contractor world. But if you just think about from the 100,000 foot level, what do you think are some of the big challenges for HR groups in this new year here?
I think the world has moved remote and hybrid. So there's this new evolving culture and leadership world that I think HR now has to work within. So when you're working with employees who want to stay remote, they want to have that flexibility, but you want to have an engaged culture, an engaged workforce. You want those leaders to be able to manage in an environment like that. I think that's really shifted since the pandemic. Most HR people that I'm working with today, or at least talking with on a fairly regular basis, are talking about this as a pretty big challenge. I think they're tackling the challenge with gusto and they're trying to come up with ways to do this. But it's one thing to align to a culture and a set of values and a mission and a vision when people are in the office and they can have conversations and you can get together and you can have events and in-person kinds of activities. But boy, when it's remote, how do you get new hires ingrained in that culture in a remote and in a hybrid world? And then the other thing that I think is shifting heavily is that folks are moving from a W-2 model of work to a 1099. So many people are looking at, hey, since the pandemic, I'm seeing other people that are running at their own small business. Is this something I can try my hand at? And very quickly, we're seeing the numbers begin to shift in the last 6-7 years, where it used to be less than, I want to say 36% of the population was 1099. And they're predicting that in the next several years, it'll be more than half of the population will be independent contractors. So that tells you that the environment is shifting. So as HR is trying to understand this hybrid world, and now all of a sudden you know, the leadership is saying, hey, can we do more with independent contract workers? It's a little less expensive. We don't have the benefits. So what can we do with independent contract workers to get the job done? CEOs now are saying that in the next 18 months, they're going to be using more 1099s than they have in the past. So the trends are there to move to 1099, but the 1099 model is very complicated.
Let's dive into that a little bit more, because you just highlighted a really meaningful shift in the composition of our workforce. This, you know, transition to having, I think it's about 85 million workers in the classified as independent contractors in the 2025 timeframe that you're discussing, which is, you know, a huge increase over the last 5 to 10 years.
Yeah.
And we also have, we're just on the cusp of having new legislation come in from the Department of Labor, new rules going into effect about how to classify employees versus independent contractors based on six, you know, kind of key factors. And this is creating a huge amount of consternation out there and a lot of questions. But the risk profile around getting that wrong, or the risk around getting that wrong, is pretty significant. So
right.
Maybe I'll ask you kind of a three-pronged question here. What kind of, speaking to that trend of growth that we just talked about and any other associated trends, maybe we can talk a little bit about your perspective on the new rules coming into play here, this new six-factor test or old six-factor test, and the risk associated with getting it wrong.
There's a lot to unpack there. So let me start by talking about the new DOL rule. So the U.S. Department of Labor, they had a new ruling designed to provide employers with enhanced guidance when determining whether an employee or a classification should be an employee or 1099. So the new rule applies six factors to determine worker status: opportunity for profit and loss, investment by the worker and potential employer. So investment by the worker, how much are they investing in their own tools of the trade, things like that. Degree of permanence in the relationship, which is complicated because if you find someone you really like to work with and they really like to work with you and you create a little bit of a permanent relationship, they're going to evaluate that to see if that worker has the ability to work for others and does work for others. Just because they have the ability to doesn't mean that you can prove that they did. The nature and degree of control. So direction and control are two different things that they're evaluating. You might be able to provide direction, but you cannot control how they go about doing that work. Extent to which the work performed is an integral part of the business. So in delivery, for example, which we do a lot of independent contract workers, we pay them in delivery. If the owner of the company is delivering and the 1099 is delivering and it looks and feels the same, then it probably is an employee relationship. And so they look to see how integral the work performed is to the core of the business. And then the skill and initiative of the worker as well. So you look at those six factors and you think about an independent contract workforce. And by the way, just a note on this, this goes very similar to the Obama era ruling by the U.S. Department of Labor back in the Obama years. When Trump was in office, they changed slightly, a little bit more, a little easier to pass, if you will. It was a multi-factor test. There were a few more points there. But now we're back to a little closer to the Obama era rule. So it's not unfamiliar to us that work with 1099s every day. But it is tricky for HR departments in particular to be cognizant of that at all times, because even when the ownership of a company knows exactly what the difference is between a 1099 and a W-2, they understand these six factors. The HR department understands these six factors, and everybody is working very hard to make sure that they're meeting those and they can pass that test. The problem is that it's not always the owner and the HR department that's working with the 1099 worker every day. So it's the ops leaders that are talking to the 1099s as they're issuing the work. And they might say things like, you know, it's a lot is terminology. Hey, are you going on PTO next week? Let's get this done. Well, PTO, obviously, for those HR directors out there that are listening, is obviously an HR term for an employee related benefit. And so when you use terms that are employee specific, then now you start to get into trouble. So even if HR understands these rules well, that doesn't mean the company leadership understands these rules well and are managing them and the complications around the language and doing it in a way that will keep that company protected. So it gets very, very complicated. And if you think, if you're an HR director and you're thinking about this, you know, managing employees is complicated. You have tax withholdings, you have all of the benefits that you're providing and managing. You've got that open enrollment that you're doing every year. You've got ACA requirements you have to meet, the compliance you have to meet as they're onboarding. All of those things are very complex. Well, it's the same in the 1099 world, only it's a vendor. So you have to be very careful about how you're setting these things up, and they need to be separate. Because if you remember one of the rules I mentioned, separate direction and control, right? So you can't have all of this in the same system. They need to be handled separately. And it's not that difficult if you only have one or two 1099 workers, but you start adding, you know, tens of hundreds and sometimes thousands of 1099 workers. And you can see that the complexity just begins to really grow. And I think it's important to understand the impact if you don't do it right. These classification audits and claims are growing. And as they grow, so do the judgments. So DoorDash, for example, had $100 million dollar judgment not too long ago. Instacart had a $46 million judgment. These are companies that work almost exclusively with 1099s. So these are big dollars. And so every company should understand this. They should understand this well, and they should know what their company policies are around how to work with 1099 if they're going to have them in their system at all.
That's a big answer to the question, and I'm taken aback a bit by some of the risk profile of a couple of the situations that you mentioned there. It's absolutely huge, and there's a retroactive nature, right? I mean, the penalties and so on go back meaningfully, so the penalties can be quite large.
Yep.
I'm really interested in your thoughts around this next question from a couple of different perspectives. One is the perspective of a CEO who manages a company that is working with the HR community and specifically independent contractors within that community. And then just as a CEO managing your own company and having your own HR focus, what is maybe one trait that you can think of that you think is really important for an HR leader to have? And given some of these changes in the composition of the workforce, maybe without that trait, it would be a little difficult for them to manage through this.
So first of all, I think that's a really good question, because I think HR finds itself oftentimes kind of in the crosshairs of all of these things, trying to manage between what the leaders are trying to do and the compliance in the law and protect the company against audits and claims and the like. So I have a saying that I use with my HR leaders, and that is seek to understand, seek to support, right? So when they are when they're navigating the company leaders and they're trying to work with them, with the employees and all of the things going on, their role is often to just try and understand what's happening and then provide their insight based on their expertise. And they have to have the expertise in compliance regarding the workers that are working within that organization. If you have W-2, you have to have the competencies to understand all of the compliance and the benefit requirements by state, the states that those workers are in. And it's important to understand how the company is executing on those and to ensure that they're meeting the law and the requirements for those workers. It's the same with 1099. So they have to understand this. Everything that I'm explaining regarding this new test, they should know what these six factors are, and they should understand how they're being executed on the job. But that doesn't always mean that each leader knows and understands that. And so first seeking to understand where each leader is at, and then making sure that they're offering the right kind of advice and providing the compliance requirements, the training necessary in order to execute on these compliance requirements successfully within any organization, I think is critically important.
This might be a good opportunity to talk a little bit about Open Force and how Open Force helps the HR community and these companies to support the independent contractor communities. So maybe we can just touch on a few of the areas that that Open Force will help out companies.
So Open Force is a very unique company. We are we sit right in the middle of the new world of work with the 1099 model. When you are an HR director and you're thinking about bringing on a worker and that worker's W-2, you put them into an HRIS and payroll platform, you know exactly what to do, you're gathering their onboarding information, you're providing them with benefit options and getting them all set up for payroll, right? So that's the onboarding. Well, when it comes to 1099, you cannot do that in the same system. The more that 1099 looks and feels like an employee, the more likely you will to lose a claim, to lose a lawsuit, and to run into trouble in an audit. And by the way, all of those departments and agencies in most states now all talk to each other. They have mutual agreements to share with each other if there's ever a claim or a work comp that's denied because it's a 1099. So understanding how they are separate and making sure and ensuring that all of the compliance requirements for a 1099 are separate is critically important. So what we do is we have a platform that will onboard that 1099 worker. We will provide all of the compliance requirements that are outlined by the company that's working with that worker. We set up our workflows so that we capture all of that. We'll provide insurance options like occupational accident, auto liability, cargo, GL if they're driving, general liability and cargo if they're driving a vehicle and they're delivering goods, things like that. So we're offering options for the insurances. And then once they select all of those and they go through the enrollment process, then we will also pay that worker. So we'll pay them, we'll do the deductions for the insurances, we'll ensure that any other deductions that are required to pull out, and then we send a net pay to that vendor that you're working with. And by doing that, we also then offer that vendor other things that you as an employer cannot offer if it's a 1099, things that would be good for their small business, tax help, 401k, things they can't get from you, medical and dental insurances, so personal risk insurance and accident and health insurance, things like that. Those are all the things that we can provide to a 1099 because we're not the ones that are actually distributing the work. So it affords us the ability to provide them with things that the employer can't, but that the employer then offers to their W-2 workers. So we kind of act in that capacity and we separate direction and control.
And as you look at kind of the way that the HR community is adapting and will need to continue to adapt to this growing trend of independent contractors in the workforce, how are you seeing that evolve the Open Force's business and change maybe the way that you're serving the community?
What we found early on is that onboarding and insurance and payments were the top need, and we would provide that. But we also do provide an audit trail. So everything that we're doing is collected in the software as an audit trail. We partner with really strong compliance partners like AccuSource HR, a very good partnership. And so we're now adjudicating. We can allow the employer and the HR department, the payroll department, whoever's working with the vendor can see right in the platform all of that information and can adjudicate there in the system. And then we're creating an audit trail. So if there's ever a claim or a lawsuit, we can then download all of that and send that on to help protect both the 1099 worker and the company to say, yes, what you agreed to is exactly how this was set up, but we have the proof. So it's not just enough to say, well, this worker had the ability to do all of these things, right? They had the ability to meet all of these factors in this six-factor new DOL law that's going into effect, but can you prove that they did? So we provide the proof. Just because they can doesn't mean that you can prove that they could and that they did. And we provide the proof. So as they are going through our system and making choices, those choices are provable now because we have an audit trail. They, when they're selecting and going in and getting tax help, or they're getting something on our portal, we're proving that they're doing things that are building their small business. So we're proving that they're truly an independent business. That's the first thing. The other thing that we've been kind of pushed into, and it's good because it's good for the model, is that when you think about a 1099 worker, you want to use that worker for a certain amount of work, but now all of a sudden they have to have certain certifications. They have to have training. Mm-hmm. They have to have, and those are all employee-like, right? Getting employee training, that's an employee thing to do. But yep. With a 1099 worker, the best you can do is say, in order to meet the terms of this contract, you have to have this certification, right? That's it. That's all an employer can do. We can then say, hey, they need you to have this kind of training. Here are some resources, or here's a video to watch, or here's something that will allow you to get that certification. And we can facilitate that through the platform and show that they selected and they made a choice to do the training and they went out and got it on their own. And then now they uploaded the certification, and the employer that wants that in order to contract with them is not involved in any of that at all. So you can kind of see the complexities begin to grow with 1099 workers. The next part of where we're going and where we've been kind of pushed into as well is, when you're a 1099 worker, you also then are an employer in your own right. And so you might be hiring people because you have the right to do that, to do the work. And so now you've got a 1099 that's contracted with you as the employer. If you're in the HR department, you might be working with a 1099, and that 1099 may have 1099s doing the work. Mm-hmm. And so that then adds a layer of complexity here. And how are they insured, and do they have the right occupational accident to protect my work comp? How do I know that they have all of those things in order to do the work that I need them to do? And it gets highly complex as you go layer by layer, because as you see a 1099, they get better and faster and they're growing their business. Now all of a sudden they need people to help them, and they become, you know, an employer or a 1099 that's bringing on subcontractors to do the work. So it adds layers upon layers sometimes of complexity. And that's a lot of what we've been doing the last couple of years to build out our system in order to handle those layers of complexity.
Significant. I mean, managing that complexity that you described, creating an environment where it's a little easier to maintain that arm's length situation, and providing the substantiation of the positions that are being taken and the audit capability all makes a ton of sense and critically important, especially given the risk profile that we talked about earlier on.
Yeah.
So a little bit of a departure from the focus on what OpenForce does. I'm curious, as a CEO of OpenForce, what's your favorite part about being the CEO of OpenForce?
So first of all, I firmly believe in the vision of this organization. Our vision is enabling the world to work without limits. So this work without limits concept is, if I'm a 1099 worker and I want to grow my small business, well, to me, small business in the United States those are the gears that keep this train moving, in my opinion, small businesses. So we're growing small businesses. And I was at a National Home Delivery Association event, happy hour, that we were doing actually at the Home Delivery World in Philly a couple of years ago. And this man walked up to me after I talked a little bit about OpenForce and what we do and how we help people. And he handed me his card, and it said CEO of, and I can't remember the name of the company off the top of my head, but it was some freight company. And he said, I just wanted to say thank you and hand you my card. And I said, okay. And he said, I started with a truck and a dream years ago, and I was given the opportunity to work with a company that used OpenForce. And so I was in the OpenForce platform. It was just me and my one box truck. And I ended up bringing on more and more subcontractors. And he said, over time, I was able to build, I have 50 independent workers that work for me. And I just closed two more pieces of business. And I have 50 box trucks in my company now today. And he said, it all started there. And he said, what you provided me was the cash I needed to do the business, because we do also have cash advance. So if they're getting a little short and they need to put fuel in their vehicle or whatever work they're doing, they have the opportunity to get a little extra cash. We provided the insurances, because he didn't understand at first which insurances he needed and how to go about getting them. And because of our buying power, we have a very large network, 180,000 independent contractors that are active right now. Because of that volume, we're able to get very inexpensive insurances for them. So he was able to get the insurances he needed at a much better rate than going out to market for those. He didn't even understand at the time what the insurances needs were, what he had to get for his business. So we were able to help him do that. And then he was able to get multiple income streams. So he was able to pick up a couple different contracts through our network and as a result, really grow that small business. That right there, Dan, is why I love doing what I do with Open Force, because we're growing small businesses. And so every day we get to wake up and think about how to help a small business be successful. And I think, to me, there's really nothing better.
Oh, that's very gratifying when you're part of a key part of a success story like that, and people take the time to share that with you. That is that's a tough one to beat. That's fantastic. You know, bringing together maybe two trends that are well known in the marketplace and kind of germane to this conversation. The first one, we've talked about the growth in the independent contractor community and that change in the workforce. And there's, you know, anywhere you look in the news or media today, there's a lot of talk around artificial intelligence and its impact on pretty much all aspects of our work lives, certainly. Any thoughts around how you think AI is going to impact maybe the broader HR world, or more specifically just around the management of the workforce and this changing composition of the workforce?
Yeah. So everywhere you look, people are talking about AI right now. Data privacy, obviously, in the HR world is going to be huge. I'm going to be moderating a panel in the National Home Delivery Association forum coming up in, I think, June. We're talking about AI in last mile and the impacts of data privacy using AI in last mile. So obviously, this is a hot topic right now. I think it's going to change the way we work. Especially in some positions, I think that figuring out a way to utilize AI in a way that is meaningful for the business while protecting the data privacy policies that you have in your business is going to be challenging. And I think it's something that every business should be looking at right now. And if you're not, I think you should be. Because, you know, companies will begin to get ahead if they're utilizing AI and they're able to get things done quicker, sooner, faster. And so you'll see companies begin to get ahead. But outside of that, you know, using it responsibly, I think the companies that can figure out how to utilize AI, protecting data privacy, and doing it responsibly will be the ones that will win, right? You'll have companies that are early adopters, they'll get out ahead. But if they're not doing it responsibly, eventually that will, those houses will crumble. So I think figuring out a way to do it, what's right for your business, and finding places where you can leverage AI in order to gain some efficiencies, I think is a good idea. But doing it in a way that's responsible and protecting people's privacy, those are things that are critically important. With regards to what we're looking at right now is there's a lot of opportunity in, especially in auto liability, in the different insurances that we offer and how we can get data transferred back and forth and utilizing telematics, things like that. Those are some of the things that we're looking at. But also as a software company, as you know, what are ways we can gain efficiencies in software development, engineering? All of those areas are also places that we're looking to gain efficiency. I think it's a topic that every HR department should be looking at right now.
I agree. You know, it's in our organization, same thing, and I know other CEOs in particular that I speak to. Everyone feels like there's a lot of low-hanging fruit to be had by finding those fairly routine, repetitive tasks that can be managed by AI and just open up strategic bandwidth in really all aspects of the organization. And HR is one that, unfortunately, I think often gets overlooked in that conversation. But you take a look at a number of the repeatable processes there, and there's actually quite a bit of meat to focus AI on and open up that strategic bandwidth. And it's interesting, just tying back to your comment earlier around what do you think is one of the most important traits from an HR person is that seek to understand. That's a very kind of strategic level activity, and what you do with that seeking, and then how you turn that into action. So opening up a little more bandwidth around that is, I think, fundamentally very beneficial for an organization. So that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, absolutely.
I have a wrap up question that I think is going to become the wrap up question that we use to end every one of these podcasts. And again, very interested in your perspective as a, you know, part of the benefit we're hoping to provide here is to give people some conversation that's a little bit of a look inside the boardroom and a little bit of how CEOs and investors think about the HR function and HR professionals. And in that vein, I'm very curious to hear what is Wendy's definition of an HR hero?
Ooh, HR hero. So as I said, seek to understand, seek to support. I think that's a critical part of this. And I think as they do that, an HR hero would demonstrate exceptional leadership, empathy, and expertise in the various challenges that they handle every day, right? Recruitment, employee relations, performance management, training, organizational development. But they have a deep understanding of human behavior and organizational dynamics, right? When you think about alignment to a company culture, I think a good HR director will be able to create that alignment. But I think an HR hero, somebody who takes it to that next level, they create a sense of connectedness. I identify with the culture. I care about the culture, and I like being within and working and belonging to this culture. That's a different level in my mind. And that to me is like, it takes it up a notch. Somebody who can think at that level, but also have strength and confidence to come and say, I see alignment here, but I am not seeing this level of connectedness. And here are my thoughts about how to get us to this level. That to me is an HR hero. And they're thinking about all the compliance, and they're not doing anything that goes outside of those elements. And they're working within the workforce that they have, 1099, W-2, you know, however it's composed, but they're getting that to that level of connectedness. And I think that's a tough place to get to, especially in a hybrid world, as I mentioned early on. Well, I'm curious your thoughts.
I think what you brought up that is really critical. I look at I would say that an HR hero is a person who can get to that very strategic level and really decipher from the day-to-day functionality that are a little more task-oriented, but coming proactively to the executive suite, to the CEOs, to the board with things that are strategic insights and ways of really moving the business forward. Because look, we all know, it's painfully obvious that our businesses can never, ever, ever be successful unless we have great people. Like, that's just a reality. Everyone says it, but it's very, very true. There's a ton of companies out there that have awesome technology and are on the trash heap of failure because they didn't have a team who knew how to bring it forward. And there's other companies that have had mediocre solutions, but they've had a great team and they've been able to adapt and tweak and adapt and tweak and ultimately turn it into a fantastic solution offering. So I think the people who can bring that strategic layer is absolutely critical.
At the end of the day, we all want our companies to grow. You know, it's about growth. It's about finding the right path forward, that you know, what are we passionate about, what can we make money at, so what can we grow, but it's the people that make it happen. And so that strategic partner in an HR leader that can really help say, all right, so here's where we're going and here's what we want to do strategically, here's how we make sure that people are connected to this and can help us to get there.
Yeah, absolutely. Wendy, thank you very much for being here today.
Thanks for having me. This was a lot of fun.
And this has been Dan Philby with Heroes of HR.